Welcome to Mystery Books Podcast. I'm mystery author Sarah Rosette. This is Season 5, Episode 6, and it's all about Chapters 9 and 10 of Murder at Archley Manor. Murder at Archley Manor was published in 2018, and it's book 1 of 8 in the High Society Lady Detective series. Today I'm going to tell you about the inspiration behind one of the most colorful characters in Murder at Archley Manor. But first, I have a recent read to recommend for you. It's called A Traitor at Whitehall, and it's set in 1940s England. The main character is Evelyn Redfern, and she's working on the line at a munitions factory in London when the book opens. She crosses paths with an old family friend who thinks she would be a good fit working in the cabinet war rooms, which were the secret underground headquarters of the British government during World War II. So she begins working as a typist, and she's just barely adjusted to this routine of living underground for several days in a row when one of the girls that she works with is murdered. So Evelyn is a longtime murder mystery reader, and that, combined with her position in the typing pool, puts her in a perfect spot to do some sleuthing. So I really enjoyed the look at the Churchill War Rooms. Fascinating how that was set up. Descriptions of what life was like living there, what it was like to work in the typing pool. And also there's some descriptions about the Blitz and what that was like in London. So it's just a very interesting look at World War II in combined with a murder mystery. Now, I have reviewed some other books that are also set during World War II with protagonists who have an unusual job or activity that they do during the war. One is Season 1, Episode 3, Poppy Redfern in the Midnight Murders by Tessa Arlen. Now, interestingly, the main character in this book also has the last name Redfern, but this is a different series by a different author. And also check out Season 2, Episode 6, Olive Bright Pigeonair. That is another interesting job that was done during World War II. It's about how the British used pigeons, carrier pigeons, during the war. So fascinating look at some very unusual jobs during the war. All right, Murder at Archley Manor, Chapters 9 and 10. I want to talk to you about Sebastian Blakely. As I was doing research for the book, I read Bright Young People, The Lost Generation of London's Jazz Age by D.J. Taylor. And he went into great depth about lots of different, very well-known people from the posh set during the 1920s and 30s. So I think that was the first place I ran across the name Cecil Beaton. He was a young man who was in society, and he was a photographer. And his name kept popping up in different resources I was looking at, and he was just an interesting character. So let me tell you a little bit about him, and then I'll tell you about how that kind of became a character in Murder in Archley Manor. According to Wikipedia, it says, when Beaton was growing up, his nanny had a Kodak 3A camera, a popular model, which was renowned for being an ideal piece of equipment to learn on. Beaton's nanny began teaching him the basics of photography and developing film. He would often get his sisters and his mother to sit for him. When he was sufficiently proficient, he would send his photographs off to London Society magazines, often writing under a pen name and recommending the work of Beaton. So he was quite a character, as you can see just from that little snippet from Wikipedia. He had his own studio during the 1920s, and he worked for British Vogue as well. His photographs are really iconic images of the 20s and 30s. They were very innovative and unusual. They used like mirrors and reflections and unusual poses. They were capturing the time in photographs. And it's very interesting to look at his photographs. You can really tell a lot about the 1920s from looking at his photographs. He worked in Hollywood. I believe that was during the 1930s. And then during World War II, he worked for the British Ministry of Information, taking photographs on the home front during the Blitz. After the war, he worked in Broadway in stage and costume design. So he had just this long, wide-ranging career, and he was a very colorful character. So I like the idea of having a character who is a photographer, because a photographer is looking at the world, recording it, but they're also part of the world, but they're separate from it, and they're commenting on it through images. Now, Sebastian Blakely is a fictional character. He is a photographer in Murder at Archley Manor, And he's definitely his own personality. He's blunt and he's never one to sugarcoat anything. And he's the jester archetype. And that means he's a puck-like character. He's always doing things to create chaos. He's not into harmony and peace. He likes to stir the pot. He likes to keep things interesting in his mind. And he has a very sharp tongue. He's always willing to tell anyone the truth as he sees it. And he's not very empathetic. So he was an interesting character to write about. And I loved having him as part of the cast of characters because he always kept things interesting. So that's a little bit about Sebastian Blakely and the inspiration for a society photographer. So here is Elizabeth Klett narrating chapters 9 and 10 of Murder at Ardsley Manor.
Chapter 9. After a stunned second, I set off at a run toward Ardsley Manor, my thoughts jumbling together. Violet and Alfred, they'd planned to watch the fireworks upstairs. Had that been Violet on the balcony? Beside me, Monty sprinted toward the bulk of the house, where patches of light shone from open windows. I was nearing the base of the terrace steps when I felt the familiar constriction in my chest, as if a band was squeezing my lungs, cinching down tighter and tighter. I dragged in a ragged breath and told myself to calm down. Monty didn't notice I'd slowed my pace. With his long stride, he widened the distance between us and raced up the shallow steps. My breathing evened out once I slowed down to a less frantic pace. By the time I reached the top of the stairs, Monty was already on the far side of the terrace under the balcony. He stood completely still for a moment, staring down at the flagstones. Then he spun away, a hand over his mouth. I had my breathing under control and headed for him. He stepped into my path and caught my upper arms in his hands.
"Don't go over there."
I didn't have to go closer to see it was a man stretched out on the ground. His torso and upper body were in the shadows, but his black-clad legs were visible in a bar of light coming through one of the open doors. The unnatural angles of his lower limbs and the utter stillness could only mean one thing. It wasn't Violet. I drew in a breath, which came easier than it had a few moments ago. "Who is it?"
"Alfred."
I looked up to the balcony, but it was deserted. The fireworks continued to explode overhead, creating a flashing effect that intermittently lit up the house and Alfred's body. I turned away and swallowed hard. My surge of fear that it was Violet who had fallen faded, and I felt shaky with relief. I was grateful it wasn't my cousin lying crushed and broken on the flagstones. But the whole situation was terrible, awful. And at the same time, I almost couldn't believe what I'd seen. It was so fantastic. People weren't pushed off balconies. And yet, Alfred's body lay unmoving just a short distance away.
"The police."
The final words of Monty's sentence penetrated my thoughts. "What? Oh, right, the police. Yes, of course." They would have to be called. Monty said,
"Find Babcock, the butler, you know, and have him ring up the local police station. Can you do that?"
At his mollycoddling tone, I straightened my spine. "Of course. If I can't find Babcock, I'll do it myself." Monty raised his eyebrows, but I swept away before he had a chance to say anything else. As I left, I heard him calling for one of the footmen to create a barrier around Alfred, and for someone to alert the footman on the stairs to hold everyone upstairs. My steps stuttered for a moment, but I pressed on. Of course, Monty was right. Someone, a woman, in fact, had pushed Alfred over the balcony, and she might still be upstairs. As I dashed across the terrace, my foot skidded. I caught my balance and saw the luminescent glow of several pearls by my foot. I picked up the strand of about 10 pearls that had come to rest in the mortared groove between the flagstones. They looked valuable, and I didn't want to leave them there, but I didn't have my handbag with me or pockets in my dress. I hesitated for a second, then slipped them into my glove, where they lodged against my forearm, cool against my skin. The musicians were taking a break, and the ballroom was empty. I sped on to the reception hall, where the furniture had been pushed askew. Plates of half-eaten food and empty glasses littered the tables and the edges of the stair treads. Babcock was picking up the large silver tray that the revellers had abandoned at the foot of the stairs. I rushed to his side. "You must ring the police. Tell them to come at once. A man, Alfred Eaton, has been killed, pushed off the balcony." Babcock straightened slowly, the tray in his hand. Butlers always seemed to maintain an impassive expression, but I'd startled him enough that his eyebrows actually rose.
"How unfortunate. I will see to it immediately."
"Thank you." I took a few steps up the stairs. "And I suppose you'd better find Sebastian and let him know what's happened."
"Of course, madam."
He tucked the tray under his arm and glided over to the telephone positioned on a table under the stairs. The footman on the landing recognised me and stepped aside, allowing me to trot up the next set of stairs. Another set of footfalls sounded as someone sprinted up from the reception hall. Monty spoke to the footman, instructing him not to let anyone come downstairs. I was too worried about Violet to stop and speak to Monty. As I made my way down the corridor, I peered into the rooms on the back of the house that looked out toward the lake and the fireworks display. Alfred's door was open, but the room was empty. The other rooms on this side of the hall were occupied by Lady Pamela and Thea. I didn't think Violet would be in either of those rooms. Perhaps I was wrong. Perhaps Violet hadn't come upstairs with Alfred to watch the fireworks. But I should check Violet's room just to make sure. Violet, Gwen, and I had rooms on the other side of the hall that looked out over the front of the house. Lady Pamela's door opened. She stepped out and closed the door with a snap. I didn't want to engage in another rendition of Ring Around the Rosy, so I moved to the far side of the hall, out of her reach. But Lady Pamela wasn't interested in games. As she neared me, I saw her pupils still were large and dark, but now her attitude seemed more angry than euphoric. She wore a new gown, a shimmery pink shift decorated with seed pearls. She saw I'd noticed her dress. "That idiot Tug spilled his drink all over me," she said, then sailed down the corridor to the stairs. I tapped on Violet's door. Lady Pamela's autocratic voice floated back to me, her words clipped. "Stand aside this instant." Obviously the footman was following instructions. Monty's voice rumbled soothingly. A voice on the other side of the door called, "Come in." I stepped inside. Violet's room was similar to mine, except instead of pale green and gold striped wallpaper with cream furnishings, this room had a lavender colour scheme. Violet was seated at the small writing desk positioned between two long windows on the far side of the room. Her back was to me. She remained bent over the desk, her pen scratching across the paper. "Have you come to apologise?" Her tone was frosty.
"No."
She whipped around. "Oh, I thought you were Alfred." So she and Alfred were on friendly enough terms that she would expect him to come to her room. It appeared that their relationship was on a much more intimate level than Aunt Caroline or Gwen imagined. "What are you doing?" I asked.
It wasn't like Violet to be shut away in her room while a party was going on.
"I am writing a letter to Alfred to explain to him exactly how angry I am."
"Oh," I cleared my throat. "I'm afraid I have some bad news."
I stopped, not sure how to go on. I couldn't say it as baldly as I had to Babcock. My news would shatter her. I paused, feeling sick at the thought of what she would have to face. A tap sounded on the door connecting Violet's room to Gwen's next door. "Violet, are you in there?" The door opened an inch, and Gwen poked her head into the room. "I thought I heard voices. Hello, Olive, I haven't seen you for hours." "I know, I wondered where you were." "There was a bit of an upheaval in the kitchens. I went down to smooth things out."
"Only you would get roped into running someone else's party," I said, glad for the momentary distraction.
"I couldn't leave the poor cook on her own. She had no idea how many people would arrive for the party."
Violet closed the lid on the writing desk and turned sideways in her chair. "She must be new. Sebastian's parties are always like this. The word spreads and more people arrive. In fact, this one seems a little bit mild. People probably won't even remember it in a few weeks, despite the fireworks. That awful feeling in the pit of my stomach intensified. This party was certainly not going to be forgotten. Violet, I'm afraid I have some bad news. Violet jumped up from her chair and crossed the room to Gwen. What have you done to your hand? Gwen stepped fully into the room. She had been holding her hand pressed to her waist, but now she extended it. She had a towel wrapped around it. Someone dropped a champagne flute, and I cut myself picking it up. Oh, Gwen, Violet said. Why didn't you call for someone to clean it up? I went to Gwen and gently pulled back the towel to examine her hand. Because Gwen likes to handle things herself and not cause a fuss. It doesn't look bad. It's not deep, and the bleeding has stopped. A red scratch ran along her palm from the base of her thumb down to her wrist. It's nothing, she said. I came up to put a plaster on it. Gwen dabbed at the cut with the towel. I'll be back in a moment. Then why don't we all go down and watch the end of the fireworks? That's not a good idea, I said. In fact, I'm surprised they're still going on. Even though this side of the house overlooked the drive and we couldn't see the fireworks going off over the lake, I could still hear the pops and booms as the fireworks continued. But I suppose they haven't sent anyone over there to tell them to stop. Why would they stop the fireworks? Violet asked. There's been an... I was going to say accident, but that wasn't right. Alfred's fall hadn't been accidental. Gwen tilted her head. What's wrong, Olive? You're awfully pale. Aren't you feeling well? I'm fine. It's... Here, come over to the chairs. I drew them both over to the wingbacks positioned in front of the empty fire and had them sit down. I grabbed the chair from the writing desk and dragged it over. I blew out a breath. Then I took one of Violet's hands in both of mine. I'm so sorry to have to tell you this, but Alfred was pushed off the balcony. Violet blinked. What? Alfred was pushed off the balcony. Violet jumped up. Where is he? I've got to get to him. Why didn't you tell me when you first came in? She turned for the door, but I caught her hand. He didn't survive the fall. Gwen drew a sharp breath. Violet stared at me for a long moment. Her face became hard. I know people play pranks all the time, but this is beyond cruel. How could you even say something like that? It's not a prank. I had expected hysterics and was ready to pull Violet into an embrace and smooth her hair as she sobbed on my shoulder, but she continued to stare at me as if my words didn't make sense. But he can't be. He can't. He's here, just across the hall in his room. We were going to watch the fireworks, but he was being completely insufferable. So you were with him on the balcony? I asked. Who else was with you? No one. I mean, I didn't even go onto the balcony. We argued downstairs before the fireworks began. He was being so stubborn. I couldn't stand it, so I left him in the hallway and came in here. He's still out there on the balcony outside his room. He has to be. If something has happened to him, I'd know it. She put her hand on her chest. I'd know it inside. I'm sorry, Violet. No. Take it back. Her tone was harsh. It's not true. I said gently, I'm not lying to you. Violet's fierce expression shifted and her brows wrinkled. No. You're wrong, she said. But her tone wasn't as fierce as it had been. Gwen stood, put her arm around Violet, and moved her back to the chair, where she gently pushed her into the seat. Using her uninjured hand, she pulled a blanket from the bed and tucked it around Violet's legs. Violet stared at me for a long moment, then said, "What happened?" I mentioned what I'd seen from the lawn, but didn't describe Alfred's body on the terrace. "He was pushed," Violet asked. That means he was killed. Someone murdered him. Yes. I looked at Gwen, but she was ringing for the maid, probably to request a cup of tea or a sleeping draught for Violet. I turned back to Violet in time to hear her murmur what sounded like, Then it was true. What's true, Violet? I asked. Nothing, she said in a low voice. It doesn't matter now. The police arrived, collected the names of the partygoers, and then sent them off. It was nearly 3 in the morning when a knock sounded on the door of Violet's room. The police had asked that Gwen and I remain in Violet's room with her until we were called for an interview. Violet still huddled in the chair. She had cried a little, but mostly she stared, lost in her own thoughts. Gwen had hovered and tried to convince Violet to take a sleeping powder, but Violet only shook her head. She didn't move or react when a maid with dark curly hair and a long nose stepped into the room. "The police inspector would like to see you, Miss Olive." I stood up. "Where is he?" "In Mr. Blakely's study. I'm to take you." I followed the maid out the door. A police constable stood outside Alfred's room. I glanced into it as we walked by. The room was packed with people. The bright flare of a flashbulb temporarily lit up the balcony. The footman guarding the landing on the staircase was gone. We stepped around the debris from the party that still covered the stairs. As the maid and I neared the ground floor, a maid passed through the reception hall with a teapot on a tray. The soothing aroma of freshly brewed tea drifted in her wake. Thinking of Violet's near catatonic state, I said to the maid, who was walking with me, "After you take me to the inspector, could you see that Jane brings up a fresh pot of tea to Violet's room?" The maid gripped the sides of her apron as her gaze skidded to the left and right. "I can't." "You can't? I mean, I'll see to it, but Jane can't. She's gone." "Gone?" She lowered her voice. "Jane packed her clothes and left. Marched out the front door, she did. I saw her myself. She used the telephone under the stairs, bold as you please, to call Mr. Brown, then left."
"Mr. Brown?"
"The taxi service in the village. Jane told Mr. Brown to meet her at the front gates."
"When did this happen?"
"It must have been a little before midnight. The fireworks started not long after she left." The maid who had passed us with the tea tray a few moments earlier came out of the little room at the end of the hall that was Sebastian's study. She left the door ajar. The maid with me indicated the study door. "The police inspector is in there. I'll see to the tea for Miss Violet," she said. She was obviously flustered, because instead of escorting me into the room and announcing me, the maid ducked her head and scurried away, leaving me outside the door. A male voice rumbled on the other side of the door.
"Don't hold with all these rambunctious young people. Pack of trouble, that's what they are. Haven't had a moment's peace since Mr. Blakely moved into the neighbourhood. Motor cars tearing through the village at all hours. Constable Finney had to run them out of the fountain on the green last month, splashing about in it after midnight. You mark my words, this is nothing more than a lover's quarrel gone bad. The young woman was probably drunk, or she's a drug fiend. She gave her intended a shove. That's what happened."
Indignation blazed through me. Calling Violet a drunk or drug fiend. This police officer hadn't even spoken to her. He couldn't know a thing about her yet. A different voice, also male but more muted, replied,
"Remains to be seen, Inspector. We'll do our part tonight. Then I'll ring Scotland Yard. This is a matter for them. With all of these posh names, we definitely need the Yard in on this."
It wouldn't do Violet any good if I lost my temper. I took a deep breath through my nose, squashed down the outrage I felt on Violet's behalf, and rapped on the panel of the door. A rotund man with a bald head was seated behind a desk at one end of the room. He didn't look up from his examination of an open pocket watch on the desk. The other man in the room had a thatch of coarse brown hair, a luxurious moustache, and was dressed in tweed. He was more courteous. He rose from a chair that had been swivelled away from a credenza with a typewriter. He extended his hand.
"I'm Chief Constable Warren."
I shook his hand. "Olive Belgrave, pleased to meet you.
This is Police Inspector Jennings."
The man behind the desk finally lifted his bulky frame from his chair a few inches and gestured to the chair in front of the desk.
"Have a seat."
"I'm glad you wanted to see me," I said. "I can tell you one thing straight away. Violet didn't do it." The inspector lifted a plump hand.
"Let's not get ahead of ourselves."
He checked the watch, which was centred on the desk.
"First, name and residence."
He jerked his head toward a man in the corner, a young constable with a shiny pink face and a pencil poised over a notebook. I gave my name and my London address,
at which the inspector raised his eyebrows.
Not one for swanky digs, then?
It's temporary.
And this Miss Violet Stone is a relative?
My cousin. As is her sister, Gwen.
Naturally, you would defend this Violet Stone.
Naturally, but it is the truth. I know Violet. She wouldn't do something like this. She told me she left Alfred in the hallway and went into her room.
So she admits she was upstairs?
In her room, not on the balcony.
He made a noise that indicated disbelief, then looked at the watch again. Right, moving on. About the balcony. I understand you saw the whole thing from the lawn.
What little there was to see in the darkness. I described the struggle and the brief glimpse of the figures when the firework lit up the house. Inspector Jennings drummed his chubby fingers on the desk.
And your cousin Violet? She has blonde hair?
Well, yes, but that doesn't mean she was on the balcony. Plenty of people at this party have blonde hair.
But she was the only one who had had an argument with the victim.
Inspector Jennings gave me a perfunctory smile and checked the pocket watch.
I believe we've taken enough time with you, Miss... Belgrave. That will be all.
He looked at the constable.
Have her escorted upstairs. Let's have the fiancé in next.
Chapter 10. I woke with a start. Why had I been sleeping in a chair? The room was dim, but sunlight radiated around the closed green drapes. Oh, yes. It all rushed back. Archley Manor, Alfred's death, and that police inspector who seemed to have decided Violet was guilty. I straightened and massaged the kink in my neck. Last night, Gwen had insisted on accompanying Violet to her interview with Inspector Jennings. I had returned to my room and sat down in the chair beside the empty fireplace, but I'd left the connecting door between my room and Gwen's open, thinking I'd hear them when they returned. I must have slept through any noise they made. I stood and rotated my shoulders, then stretched my arms. I still wore the white dress with the gold overdress, but it was creased with wrinkles. I walked to the windows, drew back the curtains, and blinked against the bright sunlight. It was a gorgeous summer day with a bright blue sky above the dense trees. I opened the window, and a breeze ruffled the drapes. Some of the paper lanterns had fallen out of the trees and were scattered across the lawn. The morning dew had coated them, and now they had a sad, deflated look. A servant moved across the grass, picking up the lanterns, bits of trash, cigarette butts, and discarded plates and glasses. The grinding noise of an engine filled the air. Then a lorry with the name of a caterer emblazoned on the side came around the house from the back entrance and lumbered along the drive toward the main gate. The police must have finished on the terrace and ground floor. Last night they'd banished everyone from the north side of the house, where Alfred had fallen. I went to the connecting door between my room and Gwen's, which was still slightly open, as I'd left it. I pushed it back another few inches. Gwen sat in front of her dressing table, her loose hair spread across her shoulders. She was wrapped in a dressing gown and held a brush in her hand, turning it over and over as she stared at the glass. My movement, reflected in the mirror, caught her attention.
"Oh, good. You're up. I didn't have the heart to wake you when we came back from speaking with the police."
"How did that go?" Gwen put the brush down and rubbed her forehead.
"Terrible. That awful man from the police thinks Violet pushed Alfred. And I think the only reason he didn't arrest her last night is because an inspector from Scotland Yard will be here later today."
I had the same feeling about him, that he suspected Violet. But that premise is absurd. Heaps of people came to the party. And who knows how many of them came upstairs?
Gwen looked up. "What do you mean? Sebastian had footmen stationed at the main stairs as well as the servant staircase to prevent anyone from wandering into the rooms above the ground floor."
"Well, yes, but who's to say someone didn't slip past a footman or perhaps bribe their way upstairs? And even if we're only considering people who could legitimately get beyond the footman, Violet wasn't the only one upstairs."
Someone else was up here at that time?
Yes, reams of people, actually.
Who?
Lady Pamela, for one. She came out of her room when I came upstairs to find Violet. Thea had retired to her room with a headache, and I know Jane was tending to her. Who knows who else was on this floor at that time? Anyone could have been lurking behind all the closed doors.
I was up here too.
Gwen smiled briefly.
But I don't think the fact that I, or anyone else, was on this floor will have any impact on what the police think. They seem to have made up their minds.
She aligned the brush with a comb.
I had to telephone Mum this morning. It was awful. She's so worried. On top of everything else, Father has come down with something,
Gwen said, her voice wavering.
Gwen, what's happened? The doctor suspects it might be the...
Gwen took a breath.
The flu. Oh, Gwen, I'm sorry, that's awful. I'm sure he'll be fine, though.
After the horrible flu epidemic a few years ago, just the word flu sent a chill through me. Gwen blinked and sniffed.
Yes, I'm sure he will be too. It's all that tramping around the estate. Mum said it was especially damp a few days ago and he was out the entire day. I'm not going to tell Violet. She has enough to worry about right now.
Gwen picked up her handkerchief and blew her nose.
The doctors quarantined everyone at Parkview. Otherwise, I'm sure Mum and Father would already be on their way here. Father's contacted his solicitor, but the solicitor is in Ireland.
Gwen tossed the handkerchief onto the dressing table.
Everything is so terrible right now. When word gets out in Nether Woodsmore, Mum will be devastated. The whispers. You know how monstrous people can be.
Yes, I know. They can be vicious, especially in a village. I pressed my lips together, remembering the gossipy murmurs I'd heard in Nether Woodsmore as a child about Mum, and about me too. After Mum rode a bike through the village wearing trousers, I could still hear two of the old biddies as I waited behind them at the chemist. Unaware of my presence, Mrs. Nettlebury said to Mrs. Taylor, "What can you expect? She is American, after all. Common, not up to our standards at all. I have no idea what the dear vicar sees in her." Since something as innocuous as my mother's clothing set them off, I hated to think what the reaction of some of the villagers would be to the news that Violet was caught up in the investigation of Alfred's death. I moved across the room and sat on the end of the bed. "Don't worry about Uncle Leo. You know he's as strong as an ox. He'll be fine in a few days. Just think of what a horrible patient he is, and be glad you're not the one trying to convince him to stay in bed and rest." Gwen's nervous fingers were fiddling with the brush again, but she made an effort, and a tiny smile appeared.
"Yes, that is true.
And as far as the police's opinion about Violet, we'll just have to find someone else for them to consider." Gwen stopped fingering the brush.
"Do you think it's possible to find someone else? And is that quite fair, to divert their attention onto someone else?"
"Gwen, dear, you have to stop being so tender-hearted. Is it fair to suspect Violet simply because she was on this floor? Really, that's all they have to go on," I said. Gwen's forehead wrinkled.
"No, it's not right of them to decide it was Violet with so little to go on."
Her face cleared, and she swiveled fully toward me.
"You can do it."
"Of course I'll do anything to help Violet." We'd grown up together. I would do everything I could to help Violet. Gwen, Violet and Peter were like siblings to me. And Gwen was right about the scandal. It would devastate Aunt Caroline. Uncle Leo didn't mind things like that so much, but Aunt Caroline wasn't so lost in her painting that she wouldn't notice the sting of gossip. Gwen's face became animated.
"No, I mean you can investigate this, like you were investigating Alfred."
"But that was different. I was only looking into his background." Gwen said,
"It's not that different. You've already found out some information, like who was on this floor. Now you just need to find out who had a motive to push Alfred over the balcony."
"When you put it like that, it doesn't sound at all like meddling in a police investigation."
"You wouldn't be meddling. A few questions here and there."
She came over and sat on the bed beside me. I don't know if you heard that Violet and Alfred argued, and several people overheard them. Tug mentioned it to me. A look of distaste crossed Gwen's face. Not a very pleasant young man.
So you danced with him too? I asked.
You mean, did I try to keep him at arm's length to stay out of range of the fumes? She grinned, then turned serious again. In any case, the fact that Violet and Alfred argued... Well, I'll be the first to admit she has a temper, but Violet would never do anything to actually hurt Alfred.
Yes, I agree.
But the argument is awfully significant, at least in the eyes of that police inspector. Last night he kept going on and on, asking Violet about it. She said it was about whether they should sit out a dance or not, which I don't believe for a minute. So that's three things against Violet. Her relationship with Alfred, she was on this floor, and she and Alfred argued. This inspector from the Yard may be completely different from the local police inspector. The Scotland Yard inspector may have an open mind.
But what if he doesn't? No, you've got to do it.
She straightened, her face alight.
I know. I'll pay you.
I opened my mouth to protest, but Gwen squeezed my hand.
I know you need the money.
I don't think. I won't hear anything else about it. Consider this an extension of our earlier decision to have you search out the truth about Alfred, Gwen said in her best Lady of the Manor voice. Then her shoulders sloped, and worry filled her expression.
You will do it, won't you? You're so good at this kind of thing. I'd be hopeless at it. You're marvellous at finding things out.
I wasn't actually doing that well where Alfred was concerned. It had all been a dead end, in fact.
Please, we'll work together. You're miles better at something like this than I am, but I'll do what I can.
Yes, you do tend to see the best in everyone. If I left it to you, you'd never have the heart to name another suspect. She laughed. I wouldn't go that far. It is my sister we're talking about. But you're right. I do tend to assume the best. I couldn't turn her down. I patted her hand. While I, hard-hearted working girl that I am, don't have any such qualms. I bathed and changed into a pale yellow dress with white piping on the sleeves and collar. It was too frivolous for a job interview, but it was perfect for a country house visit. I couldn't do anything about the dark circles under my eyes, but I dusted my face with powder and added a touch of colour to my lips. I selected a long necklace of bugle beads, which reminded me of the pearls I'd found on the terrace. I probably should have given them to the police inspector, but after his immediate assumption of Violet's guilt, I'd decided to hold on to them and give them to the inspector from Scotland Yard. When I'd taken off my gloves, I'd left the pearls inside them. With all the confusion around Alfred's death, a maid hadn't been up to tidy my room or put my clothes away. I went to my dresser and shook out the glove. The string of pearls rolled across the dresser, milky white and perfectly matched. I dropped them in my handbag. The pearls were the least of my worries. If the inspector from Scotland Yard wasn't reasonable, I would still do everything I could to make sure he widened his investigation beyond Violet. I'd made a promise to Gwen, and I'd fulfil it. It seemed the best place to start was with the other people who had been on the second floor last night. It was only a little after 8. I was sure that Lady Pamela wouldn't emerge from her room for hours, and Thea was probably still asleep as well, so I couldn't make any progress there. But I could find out more about Jane. She'd definitely been buzzing with strong emotion when she had come to Thea's room, and she'd left Archley Manor shortly afterward. I rang for a cup of tea. When the maid brought it, it was the same dark-haired young woman with the long nose who had escorted me downstairs. I wondered if she'd gotten any sleep at all. She put the tray down and was about to leave when I asked her, "Has Jane returned?"
"No, miss. I don't expect she will. I think she's gone to London to stay with her sister."
"Did Jane go to London often?"
"As often as she could. Her sister works in a bank. Jane said that someday she'd be able to work there too. I thought it was all talk, but I suppose it has to be true now that she's gone and left. After Mr. Eaton spoke to her so harshly, I'm not at all surprised she left."
I hadn't heard about this. Something happened between Jane and Mr. Eaton?
Oh, nothing, I'm sure. A small misunderstanding.
She moved toward the door.
If that will be all?
No, wait, it's important. Jane and Alfred argued?
She gave a small nod.
And what did they argue about?
I don't know, miss. I only saw them from down the hall. Mr. Eaton was rather looming over Jane, pointing at her. He was mad. I could see that by his face. He was frowning and jabbing his finger at her. She pushed his hand away and said something impertinent, I thought, by the look of it. Then Jane walked away. That's all I saw, I promise. I didn't hear a word they said.
I couldn't draw any more details out of her, so I dismissed her, drank my tea, and ate the buttered toast on the tray. I left my room by the door that opened onto the hallway. I walked past Gwen's door and knocked on the door to Violet's room. I'd convinced Gwen to lie down and rest for a while. She hadn't slept at all, and I didn't want to disturb her. The doors on the other side of the hall were closed. Light showed under Alfred's door, but Lady Pamela's and Thea's doors were still closed, and no light showed from under them. I tapped on Violet's door. No response came from the other side, so I peeked inside. Violet, wearing a lilac dressing gown, was curled into the corner of one of the chairs positioned in front of a roaring fire, her head resting against the wing. Without lifting her head, she glanced at me, then returned her gaze to the fire.
"Goodness, Violet, it's stifling in here."
"I can't seem to get warm."
"Then you should get dressed and come outside. It's a beautiful day and the sun is bright. It'll be hot soon."
"I don't want to see anyone. I don't want to talk to anyone either."
She shifted her shoulder, turning away from me slightly. I sat down in the chair across from her. "Violet, I know you're upset about Alfred."
"It's awful,"
she said in a small voice that was unlike her usual robust tone.
"I don't want to think about it, but it's all I can think about. And then there's that ghastly policeman. He thinks I pushed Alfred. It's like an endless carousel in my head. First Alfred and then the police. I was afraid that they were going to take me away. And then what would I do? What would Mum and Daddy do? They'd be crushed, absolutely crushed."
"Then I suggest you help me prove you didn't do it." I spoke with the starchy tones that Nanny at Parkview used on Gwen, Violet and Peter when they were young. Violet was already distraught, and I didn't want to give her any reason to become more emotional than she already was. I wanted to ask her about the argument between Alfred and Jane, but decided to hold off. She was in a fragile state, and it wasn't the right time to fire questions at her. She looked at me out of the corner of her eye.
"But how can we do that? I was in this room alone. There's no way to prove that."
"No, but we can prove that someone else could have been on the balcony besides you." Violet turned. Her hair was pressed flat against her head where she'd been leaning on the chair.
"Like who?"
"Well, there are lots of people who might be possibilities."
"Who?"
"Lady Pamela, for one. She was upstairs at the same time you were. I saw her when I came up to find you. I'm sure she's sleeping now. It would be incredibly bad manners to burst into her room and ask her about last night, so we can't talk to her right now. But I intend to talk to the footman who guarded the landing. I'll find out who else came upstairs. Then there's also the maid, Jane, who left sometime last night and hasn't returned. I want to discover where she's gone." At the name of the maid, a spark of interest appeared in Violet's eyes, but then she dropped her gaze to the arm of the chair and ran her finger over a seam.
"Anyone else?"
"Thea had a migraine." With the extreme pain Thea had been in, I couldn't picture her wrestling with anyone to shove them over a balcony. She was either asleep or incapacitated from her headache, but I'd still like to talk to her later today when she finally comes out of her room. Violet traced the seam, giving it all her attention.
"I suppose I could get dressed,"
excellent idea. I went downstairs and asked Babcock where to find the footman who had guarded the landing during the party. If he was curious as to why I was asking about a footman, Babcock didn't show it. With his face impassive, he told me George had gone to retrieve the breakfast tray from the nursery and would be down shortly. I trotted up the stairs to the first floor, then went down the hallway to the narrow set of stairs at the end of the corridor, the servant's staircase that ran from the top floor to the kitchen on the ground floor. I climbed the bare wooden stair treads to the next floor and met the footman as he backed out of the nursery door, a tray with empty plates balanced in one hand. I didn't want to startle him, so I waited until he'd closed the door and turned in my direction. "Hello, George. I'm Miss Belgrave."
Yes, miss, I remember you from last night."
I eyed the full tray, which had to be heavy. "Excellent. I won't keep you. I have a question about last evening. Who went upstairs shortly before the fireworks began, or right after?" He wasn't quite so schooled as Babcock in keeping his expression blank, and a flare of surprise showed on his face for a second before he cleared it and said,
"Besides yourself, I saw Miss Violet and Mr. Eaton, as well as Lady Pamela, and—"
He stared over my shoulder as he thought.
"And Miss Stone."
"What about Mrs. Reed?" I asked. "Did she leave her room after I brought her up?"
No, miss."
He adjusted his grip on the tray. "I'll walk with you to the stairs," I said, and turned. He followed me as I asked, "And Jane, the maid, what about her?"
"She came up, but that was earlier, when you were with Mrs. Reed."
"And did she come down?"
"Yes, miss, she was carrying her suitcase."
"And she didn't go back up later?"
"No, miss."
We reached the staircase, and I nodded to it. "What about these stairs? Could someone have come up or down them?"
"No one did."
"How do you know that?"
"Tommy was on duty at the base of these stairs. I spoke to him last night, and he said no one came by him."
"He's sure?"
"Yes. You can speak to him if you like, or cook. Anyone going up these stairs would have to go right by her, too."
"Thank you. I'd like to do that." George nodded, and I preceded him down the back stairs, which I think shocked him a bit, but I didn't see the point in retracing my steps to the main staircase, then walking around to the kitchen through the main rooms of the house, when I could go directly down from where I was. I emerged into the kitchen, startling the servants into a brief silence. I smiled and crossed to the cook. "Sorry to disturb you, but I have a question about last night."
"Don't we all, dearie? Don't we all? I'm Mrs. Finley," she said. "How can I help you?"
I smiled at her, glad she was the informal type. I looked over my shoulder to the stairs. "Did anyone go upstairs last night?"
"Heavens no," she said. "That's the one thing Mr. Blakely won't hold with, people stumbling about upstairs unsupervised."
She picked up a skillet and waved it back and forth as she shook her head.
"No, Tommy stood on guard the whole evening. As I told the police, he's a good lad and wouldn't let someone slip by."
She pointed the skillet at me.
"And they'd have to get by me as well."
The staircase was in plain sight of most of the kitchen, so I didn't see how someone could have gotten by unnoticed. Cook leaned in and said,
"George and Tommy wouldn't let anyone go upstairs. It'd be their job if they did, and neither one of them would want that."
I asked after the maid who had brought my tea that morning. I learned her name was Millie, and I found her in the ballroom, scrubbing the floor where a drink had been spilled. She scrambled to her feet as I crossed the parquet. "Hello, Millie. I have another question about Jane. Do you know where her sister lives in London?"
"Yes, miss. She has a room not far from where she works."
"But do you know what part of town it's in?"
"No, but the address is on a stack of letters. Jane left them in the dresser in our room. She was in such a hurry when she packed that she forgot them. I found them this morning and put them aside for her. I know she'll want them."
"It's important I get in touch with Jane. Could you get one of the letters for me?"
"Yes, miss."
Millie left and returned with a stack of envelopes. I copied down the return address from one, then went to look for Violet in the breakfast room, but she hadn't appeared. She must have changed her mind and decided to stay in her room. I asked for Gwen's motor to be brought around. I knew Gwen wouldn't mind if I borrowed it. While I waited, I wrote Gwen a note, letting her know I was using her motor and I'd be back later. I penned a second note to Violet and sent it upstairs to her. The mint-green Morris Cowley rolled to a stop on the sweep as I pulled on my gloves. The chauffeur held the door for me, and I climbed in. I released the lever, and the motor was rolling forward when Violet dashed out the front door. I applied the brake. She gripped the top of the door.
"Where are you going?"
"To London." Her eyebrows shot up.
"You can't do that."
"Why not?"
"The police won't like it."
"Did the police specifically tell us we couldn't leave?"
"Well, no."
"Then it will be fine, I'm sure. And I am coming back. I'm only going to dash up to town and find out what happened with Jane. I got her sister's address from one of the maids. It should only take a few hours at the most."
"I want to come with you."
"Then climb in." Violet's grip on the door tightened.
"You don't think we'll get in trouble?"
"I have no idea. If we do, we'll beg for forgiveness." One corner of Violet's mouth turned up. "That's usually how I operate." "I know. I'll wait while you get your hat."
That was chapters 9 and 10 of Murder at Archley Manor, which was narrated by Elizabeth Klett. I'll be back week after next with the next chapters. If you want to continue the story right now, you can get it in ebook, audio, or print at sararosettebooks.com. Happy sleuthing, and see you next time.